Good morning and welcome to Shattering Myths. I am Yada. Each weekday here on GCN, we strive to expose the destructive myths associated with religion and politics, patriotism and the media, and with military and economic schemes. Instead of merely presenting the news, our mission is to understand what is actually occurring while predicting how these events will shape our world. Then during our second hour, we're going to engage God on His terms through evidence and reason, since this is the lone voice of truth in an exceedingly troubled world. Our phone number for those who would like to participate in this discussion is 877-300-7645. In 1999 in Moore, Oklahoma, the first recorded F5 in human history devastated the community. And then in April, if we just go back and look at the last couple of years, in April 25th through 28th of 2011, a tornado outbreak was the largest ever recorded, all of human history. That outbreak affected southern, midwestern, and northeastern portions of the United States, leaving catastrophic destruction in its wake, especially across the state of Alabama. It produced destructive tornadoes in Alabama, Arkansas, Georgia, Mississippi, Tennessee, and Virginia, and affected many other areas of the southern and eastern United States. In total, 358 tornadoes were confirmed by the National Weather Service in 21 states from Texas to New York and in southern Canada. Widespread and destructive tornadoes occurred on each day of the outbreak between April 25th and 28th of 2011, with the 27th being the most active day, with a record of 205 tornadoes on that one day alone. Four of the tornadoes were destructive enough, four of them, to be rated EF5s on the Enhanced Fujita scale. The first F5, 1999. In 2011, in the spring, nonetheless, there were four F5s. In total, 348 people were killed as a result of the outbreak, and that's actually less than the total number of fatalities, because there were 24 that were caused not by the deaths, caused not by the tornadoes, but by other thunderstorm-related events, such as straight-line winds, hail, flash flooding, or lightning. 1999 to 2011, the first in recorded history to four on one day. 2011 in the spring, the worst tornado outbreak in recorded history. The year 2012 began with an unusual number of tornadoes during January. You know, it's typically during the summer months that we experience these terrible storms, but now they're occurring much earlier in the year. The first major tornado outbreak occurred in January 22nd and 23rd of last year, when a spring-like system moved across the Mississippi Valley, producing at least two dozen confirmed tornadoes across Arkansas, Kentucky, Mississippi, Tennessee, and Alabama. As a whole, January was the third most active in recorded history, behind 1999, the year of the first F5 in Moore, Oklahoma, and 2008. Are you noticing a trend? So then yesterday in Moore, Oklahoma, a giant tornado, a mile wide or more, some say portions of its path that was 2 miles wide, killed, well, the lead articles talk about killing at least 91. That number is actually debatable. It's not certain. Maybe overstated. Could be understated. We really don't know at this point. It does appear that 20 children are dead. It tore across large swaths of Oklahoma City and its suburbs, flattening large areas of Moore, Oklahoma. Amy Elliott, a spokesperson for the Oklahoma City Medical Center, said at least 91 people had died, including the children. An official said that the death toll was likely to climb Hospitals reported at least 105 people seriously injured, 70 of them children. The Plaza Towers Elementary School, if you look at a map of this storm, it was right in the center of the storm, was reduced to a pile of twisted metal and toppled walls. Rescue workers were able to pull several children from the rubble, but on Monday evening, crews were still struggling to cut through the fallen beams and clear debris. At Briarwood Elementary School, which is interesting in that the two elementary schools that were the most devastated were just within blocks of each other. The roof was torn off. Numerous neighborhoods were completely leveled, Sergeant Gary Knight said of the Oklahoma Police Department. Neighborhoods are just wiped clean, a spokesperson for the mayor's office. And Moore said that emergency workers were struggling to assess the damage. She said, please send us your prayers. Witnesses on said that Monday's tornado appeared more fierce than the giant twister that was among the dozens that tore up the area on May 3, 1999, killing more than 40 people and destroying thousands of homes. That tornado ranked as an EF5, as we mentioned, with speeds greater than 200 miles an hour. The 1999 tornado ranks as the third costliest tornado in U.S. history, having caused more than $1 billion in damage at the time, according to the New York Times, or more than $1.3 billion in today's dollars. And just think of that. 1999 to 2013, we're told that during a significant period of that time, we're in a terrible recession. The Great Recession, as they call it. And $1 billion is $1.3 billion today. I mean, that's a one-third, at least on the lower number, just slightly less than a third. On the higher number, it's 25% deterioration of the value of the currency during a time of recession. Well, perhaps there's a storm that is far more costly occurring in America than just these tornadoes. The earliest reports this morning were that at least 24 people were confirmed dead, not the 91. Oklahoma City's medical examiner reported. Earlier, the official death toll was put at 51 with another 40 bodies found. This is the quote from the medical examiner's office, this time an unnamed source. We have good news. The number right now is 24. The prior figure of 51 dead may have included some double reported casualties. The reason that these tornadoes are so awesomely destructive and so central to end times prophecy is that in his Olivet Discourse, where Yahusha is laying out the kinds of events that are going to occur prior to his return, one of the things on the list is megaseismos. And it's interpreted in all of your English translations as megas being great and seismos becoming the term that has been usurped by geologists for their seismographs measuring earthquakes. But seismos just means moving to and fro. So it's a good term to describe an earthquake. But the seismos moving to and fro was also descriptive of tsunamis, of hurricanes, tornadoes, any massive storm in addition to earthquakes. And Yahusha said that these, amongst other things in his list, including terrorism, which is certainly falling into line, would increase like birth pangs. There's two aspects of a birth pang. One is the prior to the delivery of the child, they occur more frequently. The duration between them is shorter. And second, they are more severe. So they increase both in magnitude and in frequency. Now, for those of you who women listening to this program who've given birth to a child and men who have been there with their wives, you know that that is not a scale of any great precision in the sense that by using birth pangs, you know that the general trend is that the contractions become more frequent and that the contractions grow in terms of their severity. But each successive contraction isn't on a precise scale of, well, that the previous one was a minute 33 seconds apart, so this one will be a minute 32 seconds away. It doesn't work like that. And the last one on a 1 to 10, SMARTS scale was a 6, so the next one's going to be a 6.5. Doesn't work like that either. But we are certainly seeing, and that's the reason I went through this brief history, a massive increase, both in the frequency and in the magnitude of tornadoes. Frequency and magnitude, massive increase. You know, the same thing is true with earthquakes, with a swarm of earthquakes in the 7, 8, and approaching 9 magnitude range. An increase in the devastation of tsunamis. We are living this prediction. I will address on another program a letter that I received this morning, but one of the issues was that was raised in it was that the writer thought that my comment that about God not micromanaging, and therefore he is not about the business of averting all unfortunate circumstances. This was the example of God not going out of his way to save the child from being run over by a car in the street. And, you know, where does it stop upstream in terms of what God would have to do, and what's the consequence of that? And where do you say, okay, that's important for him to do, but this now infringes on free will? And the letter writer said, you know, all God had to do was whisper in the ear of the driver. So should God have whispered in the ear of those that don't even bother to know him, don't have any relationship with him at all? Should he have whispered in the ear of all of the children and all of the adults in the path of that tornado? Uttering this, I am Yetta. We're talking about the devastating storm that caused so much carnage in Oklahoma City area yesterday. And it reminded me of a portion of an email that I received this morning. It's one that I may address in future shows, but it happened to be on the issue of God preventing bad things from happening. It grew out of my comments that, you know, God doesn't micromanage. There is no way that he can intervene preventing accidents without making a farce out of free will and of his covenant. And the examples happen to be in that particular case that God were to have intervened and prevented a hypothetical child from getting hit by a car, how far does it go? So when you realize that cars, you know, in America over the last 50 years or so have been one of, if not the largest contributors to accidents and death, why not go all the way up to whispering in the ear of the designer autos of the internal combustion engine? And this emailer said that was the stupidest thing he's ever heard. But is it? I mean, one whisper there and you've resolved the 50,000 deaths that occur each year from automobile accidents. All that pain and suffering. In Oklahoma. You know, rather than whisper in the ear of all the people who were injured and killed, Why not just blow the tornado's winds the other way? Just blow at it. God, turn it the other way. In fact, why not choose every disaster that might injure or kill somebody and you reverse it? Well, then would not all resulting acts of nature be acts of God? Because the only ones that would be allowed would be the ones where he didn't intervene. When does the whole thing just become a farce?
Well, hey, Scott. When do you just not want any consequence towards choices?
Because
that's what it is. If he does all that, then he's taking away choice. He's taking away.
Why bother to give a guidance, right? I mean, why bother with the Torah? It's like Dad's advice. If your father told you, well, Scott, here's the deal. If you walk across the street without looking both ways and you just do it blindly, eventually it's going to be a catastrophic situation for you. So my advice is you don't do it because you're going to get hurt. And now if your father says, you know what I'm going to do is I'm going to shadow your every step. And every time you come to a street, I'm going to grab your head and force you to look both ways. Because I don't think you're smart enough, moral enough, decent enough to follow my instructions. So I'm just going to force you to do it.
Well, if he's going to intervene on things like that, he'll start intervening on any bad choice you make. Why?
He's not going to give you any choice, right?
He doesn't have any choice. He would,
right.
I mean... Yeah, that's absolutely,
you know,
ridiculous.
I am 5'11". I'd like to be 6'2". Why was I shortchanged? You know, I'd like to be able to play professional golf. I don't have the hand-eye coordination. That's not fair. Where do you stop?
Well, but why would you want him to do that?
Why would the, you know, if God's going to eliminate all pain and suffering, why not get rid of disease? Be no disease on the planet. Well, then maybe it just should be no death. Maybe we should just all live forever. Boy, can you imagine the world if we all live forever? Anyway, it is something. I understand the religious mindset is that the Christian God intervenes in everything, and the Christian God wants to save everyone. And we'll deal with God saving everyone when I address other aspects of this individual's email successive program. We have Glenn calling in from Philadelphia. I think he wants to talk both about the storm, and I think he has a question on the book that is misnamed after the English king. Hello, Glenn.
Hello, Yada. Yeah. First of all, before I could address all kinds of things here, we'll stick with what I said about the tornadoes. I was thinking we've shown the wind and we've reached the whirlwind.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I was talking to my friends. You know, like, you know, I vividly remember Billy Graham's old remark that if God doesn't judge America, he's going to have to apologize to Sodom and Gomorrah.
Yeah, it's funny. We may have altered our climate. There's lots of reason to suspect that we have played a role in the altering of our climate. There's no global warming, that is for sure. But we have done a lot of things that have exacerbated this planet that we have lived on, made lots of choices that have been counterproductive. Glenn, stay with us and we'll pick up. Good morning. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We have Glenn calling in from Philadelphia. Glenn wanted to talk both about tornadoes and the book inappropriately named James. And your last comment was the old Billy Graham line, and I think Billy Graham borrowed it from someone else. I think it's been used a lot, but if God doesn't judge America, then he owes Sodom and Gomorrah an apology. You know, there is a real difference, Glenn, between Sodom and Gomorrah and America. And the reality is God's not going to judge America. And that is because America is not in Yisrael. Sodom and Gomorrah was. God doesn't tolerate that kind of filth in his home. So why God said to the Israelites when they're coming back from the Exodus that there's these cities here that are filled with poison, with religious poison. And I want that religious disease taken out of my home because I know that it is harmful. I know that it is deadly. I'm not going to tolerate that in my home. Remove it. And I want you to do it personally so that you understand the consequence of how deadly the disease of religion is. And so Sodom and Gomorrah received that fate because they were in God's home. America is irrelevant to God. And I think there is one prophecy about America. It's in Yeshayahu 17 and 18 where God speaks of America, uses 12 different adjectives to describe a place that is across the sea from Israel, and the descriptions that he uses are a dead ringer for America. But the reason that America even made the prophecy was isn't that God destroys us. It isn't that God judges us. It's that America judged his home. He says that America personally intervenes to thin Israel at the waist, looting his people of his land, forcing Israel to give up Gaza, and now trying to force them to give up the West Bank to the mythical people known as the Palestinians. God says that because you have looted my land and thinned my home at the waist, he says this will be the consequence, and the consequence is not something God does; it's something Muslims do. Our largest cities are laid waste, destroyed. So that's the answer on America.
Well, I can digress. So actually, I would like to do one very brief serendipitous aside for just a second, and notice to say that your voice sounds almost identical, but to that of the actor and game show host John O'Hurley. I suspect you both grew up in similar areas of the country.
You know, I don't know. I don't know John O'Hurley. I guess I've never been a.
And he was on Dancing with the Stars a lot. I'm sure many
really. Oh, okay.
They won't talk
about. Okay.
And he was Peterman in. He was Elaine's boss in.
Hogan's Heroes. Is that the one?
No. Elaine's boss in Seinfeld.
Peterman. Okay, all right.
Yeah,
all right.
No, almost just like Peterman. But anyway.
Okay, all right. No, I grew up in Southern California, and then I moved to Virginia for a little over a decade. I'm now bicoastal, kind of going between both places. I have traveled a lot, so you do pick up little bits and pieces when you travel. I've been in almost 200 countries around the world, so I have seen a good portion of the world. Travel a lot, spend a lot of time in high school in public speaking and debate. I just loved the whole idea of rhetoric, the concept of using logic and reason to evaluate and present ideas, but. Besides,
that's challenging. Now you talk about Sodom and Gomorrah being as being in Israel. Well, if that's the case, when you look at some of the occult monuments and things going on, some of the occultic Freemasonic shrines and buildings and architecture in Israel, I gotta believe God is not pleased with that.
Well, we have an example of what God does in the book of Hosea. Because the Israelites had wed themselves to Baal. Baal is the Lord. He is Satan. And God says, because you have wed yourself to them. And there were artifacts all over Israel honoring Baal, who is Satan. And God said, because you've done that, I'm going to divorce myself of you. Good luck. I don't know you. You don't know me. And, it's going to be a very long time, almost 3,000 years, before we're going to get to know each other again. And then there's another example on the opposite side when Hezekiah recognize that all the international treaties and alliances that he was forming to protect Judea, Yehudah, from the Assyrians had failed, and that the northern kingdom was now in shambles, and almost every large town and city in the northern kingdom had been raised by the Assyrians, and they were ruthless the way that they hauled the Yehudim back into slavery, fish hooks in their noses as they dragged them back. The Hezekiah said, you know, I heard rumor that somebody found a copy of this old book that that's supposed to be from God. It's called the Torah. And one of the recesses somewhere in that that temple that we've got decorated with all that pagan paraphernalia. And he started reading it. And based upon reading it, he says, you know, I think what I'm going to do here is I'm going to cleanse every part of Jerusalem and Judah from with all of the pagan idols, all the satanic kinds of garbage that we've got everywhere. And he took a month to do it. And he rid the country of all those pagan and satanic artifacts. And then they celebrated Pesach, Matzah, and Bukurim a couple of weeks late. But they nonetheless, they celebrated it. And God killed their enemy. There was 185,000 dead Assyrians outside of the walls. He did when it comes to his children in his home, and they are following his guidance, he saves them. That's the bottom line. You want to know the key to being saved by God? Follow his guidance. You mentioned, however, the Masonic things related to the occult. You know, one of the things that, while it is true that Freemasonry is like a lot of religions, you don't know that it's of the occult until you get to the highest possible ranks, and at that point you're way too sucked in to be able to think rationally. But ultimately, in morals and dogma, at the highest level, reveals that the god of Freemasonry is in fact Satan. But it's the way that it's revealed is that. And it was one of the insights that really helped me understand Islam and now Christianity, which is that Satan does not want to be known as the adversary. He does not want to be worshipped as Satan. Satan means the adversary. That is not what he wants. And what Satan wants is to be worshipped as if he were God, which is why he craves the Lord's title. And it's not because it's God's title, but because that's the title that he craves because lords are worshipped. And so when you understand that, you understand that the most occult of all religions is actually Christianity and Islam. Because in those religions, their Lord is Satan. It's Satan substituting himself as God and rejecting the God of the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. And so it is Satan presenting himself as God, not as Satan, which makes them actually the most obnoxious of occultist religions.
This brings me back to last week's question for further clarification on your understanding of the person Yahusha. Okay,
yes.
Was he a prophet? Did he die? Did he not die? What is your doctrine on Yahusha?
Well, I don't have any doctrine, but I do have what Yahusha said of himself. I do know what Yahweh said of Yahusha. And what Yahusha said of himself and what Yahweh said of him is that he is a diminished corporeal manifestation of Yahweh. Yahweh uses the term Kodesh Kodesh related to Yahusha, which is the most set apart. The best illustration that I can use that explains the nature of Yahweh, Yahusha, and the set apart spirit is the example of take a boat out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean and dip two buckets into the middle of the ocean. Take one of the buckets of water and freeze it and sculpt it into the shape of a man. Take the other bucket of water and put it over a fire and boil it.
And it's all done, right?
Now, so what you have is you have now the entire ocean, which is this enormous thing, and you have two buckets which are set apart from the ocean that are exactly the same substance as the ocean, just a diminished amount of ocean in those two buckets. And one of those two, you froze, so it has a physical, tangible structure that you can actually feel and see. And that ice, you know, is going to melt, so it's only here for a brief period of time. But when it melts, it goes right back into the ocean. And the steam now is the same thing. It's just seawater, but more empowered seawater. And so it can do many things, like the set-apart spirit can empower us, but it's still of the ocean. And so if you look at the most set-apart and the set-apart spirit, if you understand them as God presented them, which is that God manifests aspects of his nature in different ways for the express purpose of revealing himself to us and also for him to walk the walk.
Right.
God's extraordinarily unique in a lot of ways, the fact that he's only one God. But if you look at how the real God differs from false gods, is that the real God not only talks the talk, he walks the walk. He actually himself became the sacrifice for Passover. He himself became the sacrifice for unleavened bread. He himself intervened in history to save his people from religious and political oppression in Egypt. So that's who he is.
He's touched by the feeling of our infirmities. But no doubt, yes. Now, okay, interesting. Now, I know I understand that you distance yourself from Christian doctrine and Trinity.
Yes.
But in terms of what you just said, I can't imagine too terribly many Christian Trinitarians being terribly offended by your metaphor.
Oh, absolutely. They would be.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I am, and I find it quite apt, actually. Anyway, we might not go into that because it's too contentious.
The Trinity is a purely pagan doctrine. It comes right out of Babylon. It was featured not only in the Babylonian religion, the Assyrian religion, the Egyptian religion, the Greek religion, and also the Roman religion, purely and wholly pagan, and it has three distinct personas, and in Christianity, they've turned one of those personas into their primary object of worship. Their Jesus Christ becomes the primary object of worship, and three distinct personalities emerge, and they've actually replaced the God of that Old Testament with a new and improved God of their New Testament, and nothing could be further from the truth. But hello and welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're having a discussion with Glenn, and I understand, Glenn, you have yet another question that you'd to discuss.
Yeah, on to Iacobus, right? James, I just let you hold. I'm sure you're aware of the polarity between James and his show me your faith apart from your works, so show you my works as evidence of my faith versus Paul.
Yeah, right.
And also my favorite part in James, of course, is the tongue is a world of iniquity, which is, set on fire, which is itself, of course, the whole,
You have lots of issues. The first of those is that in terms of the credibility of the Christian Bible, I think it is absolutely torn asunder by the fact that Francis Bacon, who was the most likely editor and chief of the King James, which was created purely for political reasons, because King Iams at the time didn't like the fact that the Geneva Bible was being used, because there were footnotes in the Geneva Bible which said that outside of Israel, there's absolutely no place in Scripture that authorizes kings to rule. And the kings, of course, had claimed in league with the Catholic Church for years that they had a divine right to rule, and the Bishop Bible became, and the Geneva Bible became so popular, particularly the Geneva Bible, became so popular and was undermined this, that King Iams and Francis Bacon got together and said, well, we need one that re-legitimizes this notion that kings have a right to rule. And, of course, they had to turn to Paul to create it. And did so. And that's the basis of the King James Bible. And one of the things that they did in the King James Bible, of course, is they renamed Jacob James after the king. And it just shows you how egotistical and deceptive these individuals were. There are lots of issues beyond that with the book of James. And that is that apart from Yaukonen and Matanya's eyewitness accounts, there really isn't a great stash of pre-Constantine manuscripts for the rest. There is one that has most of Paul's letters in it, P46, and it has a copy of Luke, who was Paul's pal, associated with it. But there's like only a couple of partial copies of Mark. And so when you get into the letters, what you find is very few ancient manuscripts prior to Constantine. And by the time you get to Constantine and you've got an established religion with them doing everything they can to modify the text to support their religious power, the texts become highly unreliable. And so James the book of Jacob falls into that highly suspect. You can probably trust somewhere between 20 and 25% of it, and then only if you're trying to deal with it in the original language. And unfortunately, Jacob wasn't written in Greek. It would have been written in Hebrew and then translated into Greek. So by the time you're talking about it in English, you're translating it three times over. The big issue with Jacob and the thing that you just raised falls into it. The word that is translated the faith is pistis, and when pistis was used in the first century, it did not mean faith. It meant trust and reliance. It became known as faith as a sole result of Paul's letters. Paul changed the meaning of the word over time, and that's the way languages do evolve. And if you look at Paul's letters, he never provides any evidence upon which trust and reliance can be based. And so in Paul's letters, the only way to translate pistis to convey the thesis that Paul was presenting is to render it faith, which is something that you do based upon not knowing and not understanding. You have to have faith and belief, where trust and reliance require knowledge and understanding. So that's the first aspect of it.
Well, it's contrasted with sight in the New Testament. We know, you have faith versus sight, with empirical senses versus faith.
Right. Yeah. If you look at Yahweh's testimony throughout his Torah, prophets, and Psalms, his primary instruction to us, his encouragement to us, is to observe his Torah teaching, which is, and the word for observe is shamar. It means the same thing as the description you would use in the scientific sense of closely examining, carefully considering, using your eyes and your brain to evaluate what you're seeing in front of you, so that you not only know the existence of the evidence and know how things react and work together, but also you understand what it is that you're learning from me. Lynn, we're going to return to your question after the commercial break, because there is a very interesting insight that you've hinted at that we have not discussed yet regarding Jacob and Shaul.